France, but also aided them directly by arresting airmen and pilots and turning them over to the Nazis. The matters that Tian Dye had mentioned had to do with the coming Allied invasion, and he and Morange were undoubtedly receiving orders from London right up to the eve of what would be the largest amphibious landing in recorded history. Arthur wished that he could be on a B-24 softening up Nazi targets before the strike, and Cleaver likely wanted to be dropping munitions for the resistance, rather than sitting in a freezing hut high in the Pyrenees. Although Tian Dye did not need to do so, he reminded Arthur and Cleaver that they had to watch out for and protect each other, not only across the mountains, but also in Spain. Cleaver, unable to keep his eyes open any longer from exhaustion, clasped Tian Dye's hand. Neither man said anything more. They didn't have to. Tian Dye moved next to Arthur and leaned back against the wall. Both men craved a cigarette, but could not light up out of fear that even the tiniest spark of flame or telltale puff of smoke might reveal their hiding spot. For an hour or so, Arthur and Tian Dye reminisced about their months together, now coming to an end. From Toulouse, Arthur knew that the Nazis were mounting a savage and desperate manhunt for Ricardo. Just one slip of the tongue by anyone associated with Tian Dye, or a torture-induced confession by someone in Toulouse, would mean the end of the Morange leader. For Tian Dye, the safer course would have been escape to Spain with his friends. He never even entertained that thought. He intended to continue his personal reign of terror against the Gestapo and the traitors in Toulouse. Tian Dye uncorked one of his flasks and handed it to Arthur. Arthur took a sip of brandy and returned it to him. Smiling almost imperceptibly, the leader of Morange nodded and drank. He clutched Arthur's shoulder for a moment, smiled, leaned back against the wall, and closed his eyes. Arthur did the same. Arthur was awakened by Cleaver rustling around and gathering his scanty supplies. Despite the endless pain in his back, Arthur was ready to get going. As he sat up and started to stretch, he suddenly realized that he, Cleaver, and Emile were the only ones left. The other guide had just set out with the French escapee, and Tian Dye, the two guides, and the two Belgians had also departed. Arthur was hit with an array of emotions as he quickly grabbed the knapsack with his remaining food and his flasks. He made sure that his pistol was still in his coat pocket. He wouldn't have put it past the Belgians to have rifled through his and Cleaver's belongings. The only way to truly thank Tian Dye was to make it home safe, and to make sure Cleaver did the same. The American and the Englishman started to follow Emile to the thin wooden door. All three men suddenly stood still, as the jarring tone of a scout plane's engine vibrated overhead. The sound ebbed as fast as it had approached, but it served as a warning that they were nowhere near out of danger. Ahead, somewhere across the snow and crags, if their luck held, lay Figueres, the first stop for any hope of escape through Spain. Chapter 25. A Perilous Trek. The guide led Arthur and Cleaver up another steep, snowy trail in the early evening of June 1, 1944, and halted at a gap exposing a path that twisted downward at a dizzying angle. As the three began their descent, the knee-deep snow slowly decreased in height. Within a few hours, it rose barely over their ankles. Approaching the semicircular peaks of a cirque, the men spied lights along the opposite rim of the yawning chasm beneath the crags. They flattened themselves on the trail and waited, inclining their heads just high enough from the snow to trace the lights. They were flashing in a downward direction and eventually disappeared. The Germans had no qualms about revealing their presence, as they searched for resistance fighters or escapees. Arthur pushed himself back onto his feet, ignoring the pain in his back, fingers, and toes, and with Emil in the lead and Cleaver in front of him, continued the descent. Another hour or two into the trek, the snow no longer came over their shoe tops and bare patches of earth and rock peeked through the trail. Emil was piloting Arthur and Cleaver southeast, the granite and limestone peaks of the central Pyrenees giving way to granite walls colored by gneiss, multicolored mineral formations that gave the appearance of stripes on the rocks. The three men were now traversing a wild, barren maze of mountains that were lower elevation than they had seen before. Trudging below the snow line, which started at roughly 8,800 feet above sea level, they welcomed the absence of snow, but strained not to slip on the loose little rocks that seemed to be everywhere. Every step downward and eastward brought subtle drops in the icy temperatures. The men kept walking, sipping water and munching bread and cheese on the move. When they entered a wide-open valley surmounted by another series of peaks that were not as high as the earlier ones the three men had crossed, but were still daunting, the trail leveled out. The terrain turned barren except for patches of scrub grass and wizened gray trees. The guide was hiking towards several foothills fronting a peak at the left edge of the valley. Occasional flashes of lights from the crags above them signaled that the alpine units were patrolling in force that night. Despite this, the guide did not appear too concerned, likely because the Germans were too high up to spot him and his two charges. No one relished the prospect of traversing such a long open valley, even with the night providing cover, but Emil, pointing at the valley, confirmed that they had no choice. The sudden drone of a Henschel 126 froze all three men in place. They hurled themselves onto the dirt and sharp little rocks of the path, holding their collective breath, straining not to move at all. With ample room to operate between the peaks and gaps above the broad valley, the scout plane came in low, the pilot throttling down to a near glide less than a few hundred feet above Arthur and his companions. The Henschel appeared to literally hover above them, its beacon illuminating the ground in all directions around them. The plane banked away a short distance, and then turned to pass over them again. Finally, it climbed and faded away over the peak toward which the three men were traipsing. After a few minutes went by without the plane's return, they resumed the trek. They would know soon enough if they had been spotted. Emil picked up the pace, Arthur and Cleaver's sore, stiff legs straining to keep up. White and violet cistus flowers, rock roses, filled the foothills. Wild green thyme peeked out from the rocks, and rows of vines stretched up to the edge of the peak. The climb grew steeper. With the stark granite face of the mountain looming directly above them, Emil suddenly seemed to vanish. On his heels, Arthur and Cleaver followed him into a passage barely wide enough for one man to wriggle through. A ripple of claustrophobia gripped Arthur momentarily. Again, he took several deep breaths. He squeezed through the opening into another, much wider gap. Across a sheer-walled ravine, a second peak faced the one on which Arthur stood. Similar in height and mass, the two peaks looked identical. Like diminutive, demonic eyes, yellow lights flared along the upper reaches of the opposite crag. More alpine troops had appeared, perhaps alerted by the scout plane that someone was trying to cross the valley. The hike across the lower elevation of the valley had allowed Arthur and Cleaver to catch their breath, despite the appearance of the scout plane. Now, as they climbed higher and higher again, their lungs began to burn in the thinning air. Stretches of snow greeted them the higher they hiked, but nowhere near what they had already experienced. Snowfall in the eastern Pyrenees, which were closer to the warmer climate of the Mediterranean Sea, was less than the rest of the range. Still, There was enough to make every step treacherous. Several hundred feet from the summit, Emil turned onto a hiking trail that curled around the northern slope to the southern wall, which faced Spain. The view was breathtaking. At that height, a chain of foothills far below undulated toward a massive plain dotted with vineyards, fields, and trees. The Spanish border lay just beyond, where the foothills met the plain. To Arthur's and Cleaver's horror, the horizon was already tinged with gray. Unless Emil was leading them to a cave or another hut, the American and the Englishman had to wonder if they were going to make the final leg of their journey in daylight. Across the ravine, lights still flared on the adjoining slope, and were moving downward in the same direction as the three men. Leaning back, using his walking stick as both a support and a brake, Emil began to half-step, half-slide in the thin blanket of snow. Cleaver and Arthur followed. The sun began to rise, and still the three men snaked their way down the trail. Perhaps a quarter of the way down the jagged slope, the roar of an engine all too familiar to Arthur and Cleaver pealed from the direction of the adjoining mountain. An ME-109 with tan and white camouflage paint, one of the many German fighter planes that patrolled both the northern and southern passes and trails of the Pyrenees as soon as dawn broke, ripped past the first mountain just a few hundred yards in front of the trio. The pilot raced past them, banked away from the mountains, and bore right back at them for another look. Emil did not press himself against the rock wall or fling himself face down onto the path. If they had scattered for cover, the German would have opened up immediately on them. They could only pray that the pilot could not get a close enough look to decide if they were Germans, mountain dwellers, or escapees. Arthur and Cleaver emulated their guide by staying upright, too. As the Nazi pilot surged past the second peak, he waggled his wings and vanished. He had signaled the Alpine soldiers that someone was on the neighboring peak and climbing down toward the border. Probably unable to determine just who was on the mountain and not wanting to pour machine gun fire accidentally into his own troops, the ME-109 pilot had simply tagged the three men. The white uniforms of Nazi Alpine soldiers and their shiny ski goggles flashed in the strengthening sunlight. Emil began to move faster in small but quick steps through the snow and loose rocks. Behind him, Arthur and Cleaver stumbled, keeping on their feet and fighting to make sure not to lose sight of the guide. Several sharp rocks tore through the beaten leather soles of Arthur's shoes, but his feet were so swollen and numb that he barely felt the gashes. Every brutal step now to the bottom of the mountain and to the Spanish border was a race against highly trained soldiers with sturdy, fur-lined mountain boots and sniper rifles. At one point, roughly halfway down, the gap between the two mountains dwindled to just 500 yards, close enough that Arthur, Cleaver, and Emil could see the small silhouettes of their pursuers. Several of the Germans paused, slid their long-range Mauser rifles from their waterproof shoulder sheaths, knelt, squinted through telescopic lenses, and aimed the barrels across the divide. The trio dove onto the trail just as the sharp cracks of the Mausers echoed in the rarefied air. The bullets whistled across the gap, slammed against the granite walls beneath the three men, and ricocheted with grating whines below. For the moment, the three men lay just out of the effective range of the Germans, who needed to close the distance by perhaps 100 yards in order to pick off their targets. The guide crawled into a small opening that led to a trail shielded from the attackers by a curve of the wall. Cleaver and Arthur crept on their bellies right behind him as another Mauser volley slammed into the rock below them. As the sun rose ever higher, the three men snaked down one of the tightest, sheerest paths they had encountered on the journey. Emil's familiarity with every inch of the terrain was keeping them out of the Germans' sight and range for the present. but at some point, the rarely used hiking trail would inevitably turn back toward the middle of the peak and put them back in eyeshot of the soldiers. Equally disturbing was the possibility that the Alpine troops were simply heading down the adjacent slope in order to reach the bottom first and cut off the escape route. With roughly 2,000 feet of mountain left, Emil had no choice but to lead them back on a hiking trail within sight of the Germans again. It was the only route down. Instead of a half dozen German soldiers moving single file down a trail on the opposite slope, there were at least three or four times that number. If Arthur or Cleaver expected a barbed wire fence with sentry posts along the border, they were relieved to see that only a few signs marked the crossing from France to Spain. A swift flowing river raced along the border, and an uncovered bridge carried travelers from one country to the other. Of course, the two escapees had no reason to believe that the absence of a fence would stop the Germans from pursuing them past the boundary. The only certainty for the American and the Englishman lay in their need to reach the border bridge ahead of the Nazis and hope for the best. They and their guide had to get there first, or not at all. They could no longer worry about falling. They slipped, stumbled, and slid down the final trail in a spray of snow, cracking twigs and rocks that tore their clothes and their flesh. Whenever the trail proved too steep for them to stay upright or even dip into a crouch, they slid along on their rear ends or crawled across the rocks. The three men's sole thought was to keep pushing forward. Across the divide, the Germans were also moving as fast as they could, staggering too, but their footing aided by their boots. His breaths coming in gasps and pants, his heart pumping so fast that he was afraid it would literally burst, Arthur scrambled closer and closer to the bottom behind Cleaver and Emil. Somehow, Emil led his two men at least 100 yards closer to the bottom than the Germans, but as he, Arthur, and Cleaver lurched closer to the Spanish border, the Germans were closing fast. While most of the soldiers tottered down the slope, several again knelt on one knee, braced their long-range Mausers against their shoulders, and took their bearings through their sniper lenses. The rifles barked just as the three men nearly toppled down the last few yards of the mountain. Bullets slammed into an ancient tree in front of them, and a stinging spray of splinters and sheared-off bark cut their faces and hands. All three staggered, recovered their balance, and ran with their last reserves of strength and adrenaline the few hundred yards toward the bridge. The shots whizzed just a few inches above their heads. The Germans finally had the range. As the half-dozen snipers readied their second volley, the rest of the Alpine troops pursued the three men. Cleaver wrote that the Germans were moving fast down a trail on the far side of a ravine to cut us off at the border bridge across a deep chasm. We did not need our guide's muttered exhortations to prod us to expend our remaining energy to reach that bridge before the Germans. Cleaver continued, "Our guide was relentless, pushing us far past what either Meyerowitz or I could have imagined as our physical limits." As we finally neared the border, matters worsened quickly. We got there ahead of the Germans, but several aimed their long-range rifles at us. I was certain our end was here. Arthur, Cleaver, and the guide pounded across the rough wooden planks of the bridge and crossed into Spain. More than a dozen German soldiers had stopped running toward them and were arrayed in a loose semicircle, pondering whether to cross the bridge and seize the three men or shoot them on the spot. One of the Nazis bellowed curses at them, placed his Mauser to his shoulder, and pointed it at them. Arthur and the others figured they were finished. After all they had gone through, their lives would end in Spain. "We crossed less than 150 meters ahead of them," Cleaver wrote. "Why they did not cut us down, I will never understand." In all likelihood, the snipers who had opened up a minute or two earlier had held their fire as their comrades chased the escapees to the bridge. Still, as Cleaver wrote, Why the Germans did not finish off the three men would always remain a mystery. Perhaps because the Alpine troops were not SS or Gestapo, some semblance of human decency made them hesitate. The likeliest reason was that the crossing was patrolled by heavily armed Spanish partisans, who could appear with lightning speed and seemingly out of nowhere. They despised the Nazis as much as they did Franco, and on numerous occasions tore apart German soldiers who crossed onto Spanish soil in pursuit of escapees from France. The Germans did move right up to the other side of the bridge. Then an officer, who had to be wary that he and his men might already be in the gun sights of partisans, concealed in several stands of trees and brush beyond the bridge, shouted an order. The soldiers formed a double line and marched back toward the mountains. Like Cleaver, Arthur would never understand why the Germans, so relentless in his long months in France, simply turned around and left. A new set of dangers faced them, however, and Arthur and Cleaver understood the necessity of safe houses, even in neutral Spain. With Spain crawling with Nazi and Allied agents alike, the Germans would be sure to try and make a grab for the two escapees. In Toulouse, Marcel Taillandier did not yet know whether Arthur and Cleaver had survived the first leg of their escape. The leader of Morange had suffered a devastating blow on June 2nd, the very day that the American and the Englishman made their break for the border. What of Taillandier's most important lieutenants, Achille Viadieu, whom Arthur had met at 96 Boulevard del Tour, had been unmasked by the Gestapo? The 33-year-old Viadieu, on Taillandier's orders, had tricked the Germans and Vichy police into believing that he was a staunch collaborator. He so won the enemy's trust that he was appointed the regional director of the RNP, an ultra-fascist and collaborationist unit that wore black uniforms similar to the Gestapo. Several times on Payol's orders, Viadieu had assassinated notorious traitors in Toulouse. Payol wrote, "The enemy had just figured out that Viadieu had been a penetration agent of French counter-espionage for the past 2 years." Two Gestapo agents walked up to Viadieu and shot him down in the center of Toulouse. Taillandier had moved Arthur and Cleaver out of Toulouse just in time. Through torture and murder, the Gestapo was closing in on Morange and other resistance units. Three-quarters of all resistance fighters who would die during the war fell from June to August 1944. Viadieu was one of the first of Morange to be executed in that time frame. He would not be the last. Chapter 26. Stranded. Arthur and Cleaver fell in step with Emile. Continuing eastward, he brought them deeper into the Spanish province of Catalonia. Across a wide open plain, eventually leading to a stand of fig trees and one vineyard after another. They skirted a two-lane highway that cut between the vineyards and the foothills that edged the plain. Occasionally, cars and clattering farm trucks, piled with hay, passed along the highway. But not once did a military vehicle of any sort appear. To the northeast, the now muted drone and muffled growl of Nazi scout and fighter planes grew even fainter. For the first time in 3 days, the sun's warmth beat down from a dark blue sky, and on Arthur, whose frostbitten fingers and toes alternately ached or went numb. Sweating, he removed his overcoat, slipped his pistol into a trouser pocket, and slung the coat over his shoulder. He was exhausted, hurting from head to toe. Still, the realization that every step farther from the border heightened his chance for escape and for freedom drove him onward. Emile kept them walking between rows of grapevines and trees. Flowers bloomed everywhere, turning the landscape into a carpet of myriad, almost dizzying colors, a stark contrast to the snow and barren rocks of the mountains. After an hour or so, Emil turned toward the highway and pointed to several gnarled fig trees flanking the roadway. Attuned by now to every hand signal and gesture from the Frenchman, Arthur and Cleaver understood that he wanted them to wait. They sat behind the trees, screened from the highway by the trunks and by the twisted strands of Catalan grapevines. Emil crouched just off the road, watching and waiting for something or someone. Glad for the chance to rest, Arthur and Cleaver waited too. Soon a nondescript old car with a dusty windshield slowed down and pulled off the road a few feet away from Emil. He rose from his crouch and approached the vehicle. As the front passenger window rolled down, he leaned in and began to converse with the driver. Emil stepped away from the window and waved in the direction of the American and the Englishman. Struggling to get to their feet again, their legs wobbly and twitching from spasms, Arthur and Cleaver leaned against each other to steady themselves. After a few moments, they limped over to the car. When Emil opened the rear passenger side door, the two eased themselves into the worn, ripped back seat. Emil slid in alongside them. The car slipped back onto the road and headed off at a leisurely pace. Emil, pointing forward, looked at Arthur and Cleaver and said one word, Figueres. The driver, in a beret and with a shirt whose sleeves were rolled up to reveal thick, heavily veined forearms, did not say anything, but his nose was slightly twitching. They all knew the reason for the man's reaction. The American longed for a bath or shower, but was almost too tired to care or even notice the stench wafting from him and his companions, none of whom had seen soap or water for nearly 4 days and nights. Less than an hour later, they reached the outskirts of a town and a gargantuan fortress that loomed from a dark ridge above the streets. Figueres had once been a picturesque blend of medieval and 19th-century buildings and homes. The town that greeted Arthur, however, was one battered by the Spanish Civil War. The thick-walled castle, San Ferran, had served as the outpost where the region's Republican forces had made their last stand against Franco's fascist army. With Stuka and Heinkel dive bombers supplied by the Nazis, Franco's air force had gutted Figueres, which had once been a bustling town of 40,000 people. Only about half that number now remained among the ruins. The car crawled down rubble-strewn streets and stopped in front of a stucco house whose tan walls were scorched but remained intact beneath a patched red tile roof. The guide opened the car door and beckoned for Arthur and Cleaver to follow. From behind the scarred shutters of other houses in various states of disrepair, Arthur sensed people watching. It was a hangover from the ceaseless stress of collaborators everywhere he had turned in France. Weariness flooded Arthur's thought and limbs, but he could not let down his guard, not even for a second. Once they stepped inside the house, the guide quickly shut the door as the car drove off slowly. The first floor of the building was virtually empty, a few broken chairs on their sides and backs. Dense dust cloaked every inch of the house. A collapsed staircase had once led to the second floor. In one corner, an old cast-iron stove was shrouded by cobwebs. The guide walked over to the far wall, faced the front door, unslung his carbine, and sat down with the weapon cradled in his lap. Arthur and Cleaver sat down and leaned back against a side wall. Half-dozing but still alert, Arthur was suddenly startled by several short, sharp raps on the door. A small man who looked like a clerk in his white shirt, dark tie, and black pants entered with a much larger man in a beret and a leather jacket. The man in the tie introduced himself to Arthur and Cleaver as Louis. Louis Petit. I am a courier from Arcel. He walked over to the guide and stretched out his hand. Then he asked, "Do you have something for me?" Emil reached into his pocket and pulled out an envelope. Louis opened it and, in English for Arthur and Cleaver, said, It says that the Marcel and Jeannot party has arrived in Figueres. Another set of knocks alarmed Arthur and Cleaver. They relaxed as Louis opened the door to let in two more men, both also wearing berets and leather jackets. The pair also carried large canvas satchels packed with food and a few bottles of wine. There was no mistaking the bulge of revolvers in both men's jacket pockets. Inclining his thumb at the two newcomers, Louis said, "I will take this note to the British consulate in Barcelona. These two men will remain with you until I make arrangements for you to leave here. You are not to leave this house. Stay away from the shutters and do not open the door for anyone. My men know who to let in." Louis departed as quickly as he had arrived. Emile went with him, offering a wave and a smile to the two men he had led over the mountains. Two more of the many he had taken this way before. Arthur and Cleaver remained in the house for the next two nights, resting, recuperating from the harrowing trek across the mountains. They needed to sleep, to prepare themselves emotionally as well as physically, for the next leg of the escape. Once again, all they could do was to wait for a knock on the door. Arthur and Cleaver drank a little of the dark red, robust wine and munched soft cheese, bread, and olives from the satchels. They were eating a meal in an unoccupied nation for the first time in months. Neutral Spain, however, was far from being free. Chapter 27. Goodbye, Georges Lambert. In June 1944, Arthur's and Cleaver's lives became a grueling waiting game. Their new guide, a dour middle-aged man named Miguel, returned to Figueres 2 days after their arrival to drive them the 86 miles to Barcelona, where Tailleur had made arrangements for an agent to meet them with new identification papers. No longer would Arthur have to rely upon his Georges Lambert photo ID, even though he still had it. No one had asked him to give it back. Escapees were usually required to return their IDs to their guides or the resistance groups so that the documents could be reused with different photos. With D-Day so close at hand, it is possible that neither Tailleur nor Emile believed it was necessary for Arthur to give back his ID. In Spain, escaping airmen and pilots needed papers and a photo card with their actual names and citizenship on the documents. If the Spanish police or civil guard seized anyone with forged identification, or none at all, they immediately arrested him. German agents tipped off by bribed Spanish officials were allowed to identify Allied airmen as escaped criminals and return them to occupied France. A Spaniard named Juan García Rabascal, who worked as an agent for the British consulate in Barcelona, often had to rush to various prisons with papers identifying RAF escapees whom the Germans were about to seize. To the terrified airman, he explained, "In this country, the presence of these Germans is more legal than British consulate activities." Barcelona native Roberto Garcia handled the extrication of captured escapees for the American consulate in the city. Any man who required their help was in a dire situation, and many times the Gestapo had removed prisoners before Rabascal or Garcia could arrive. Every mile between Figueres and Barcelona posed a threat to Arthur and Cleaver if they were caught without proper identification. Cleaver had no way to know that two of his crewmen had experienced this frightening predicament a month earlier. Thanks to Cleaver's decision to stay at the controls of the crippled Halifax in April, John Franklin and Ray Hindle had parachuted safely near Cognac and had been taken in and helped by the resistance, not Morange. Guides had taken them into Spain by crossing the Pyrenees above the Ponteret, farther west than Arthur and Cleaver's route. In the Spanish towns of Vieja, Franklin and Hindle, with no identification, were arrested by the Spanish Civil Guard and moved to the Seminary Vell prison in Lieja, where German agents often plucked airmen from cells and shipped them back to France. Hindle, who so reminded Cleaver of Arthur, and Franklin got lucky. Juan Garcia Rabascal raced from Barcelona to the prison with papers for both men and removed them before the Nazis could do so. Arthur and Cleaver also got lucky on the drive from Figueres to Barcelona. They arrived in the sprawling, beautiful city without being stopped and ordered to show identification. Then, in a safe house, their guide suddenly told them that he had to go to the British consulate, which, like the U.S. consulate, provided papers for both escaping British and American airmen and their documents. Arthur and Cleaver had to be concerned. This was not the plan Taillandier had explained to them. They were supposed to be met by another guide in Barcelona who would have their new identifications and other paperwork on his person. As always, Taillandier came through for the American and the Englishman. The photos and papers did arrive, and over the course of 9 days in Barcelona, Arthur and Cleaver had the option of staying in the house or moving warily around the city with their new IDs. Many Allied airmen were being harbored in Barcelona, but Arthur and Cleaver's guide had cautioned the duo to be careful whom they befriended there. The Germans could ply unwitting airmen with liquor at any of the city's countless cafes and bars and lure the men to a brothel. Many of them soon found themselves trussed up in the German consulate and smuggled out of Spain and on their way to a prison camp. During their time there, Arthur and Cleaver avoided trusting the wrong friend. As with all Allied airmen in Barcelona, Arthur and Cleaver were told that if they chose to go out, they must never break the city's curfew. Historian Alberto Poveda Longo, in his book Paso Clandestino, Secret Pass, states, "Airmen had to respect the curfew rules. The foreigner shouldn't have been in the street from 9 p.m., but during the summer they could be in the street until 11 p.m. Once again, in Barcelona, Cleaver's crewmen Franklin and Hindle made a mistake that Arthur and Cleaver avoided. One day the friends decided to visit the local cinema. When the film had finished, a couple of civil guards, Spanish, were waiting for them and moved the young men to the prison. Franklin wrote that they had broken the curfew rules to visit the local cinema. "We were escorted to jail through the main street," I thought with some satisfaction, by the civil guard. Their luck held thanks once more to Juan Garcia Rabascal, who liberated them from the small stone cell and the tiny grill window before the Nazis could make a move. "You can imagine our relief," Franklin added. On June 13th, Arthur and Cleaver finally left Barcelona. By that time, they had to know that the Allied forces had stormed ashore along Normandy on June 6th and were craving the chance to get back into the thick of it. Arthur wrote tersely that they then went to Madrid with Cleaver and three Belgians. Cleaver remembered, "We were worried that German agents would seize us. Meyerowitz, a trio of Belgians, and I reached Madrid. We had several near-disastrous run-ins with Spanish police sympathetic to the Germans, as well as spying Gestapo agents many times. We were challenged several times." As Taillandier's carefully crafted escape plan for Arthur and Cleaver unfolded, the Frenchmen and Morange were fighting for their very survival in and around Toulouse. Chapter 28. Death to France. On June 2, 1944, about the time that Arthur and Cleaver were racing the pursuing Nazis toward the Spanish border, Taillandier, identified as a person of interest based on a tip from a collaborator, was approached in Toulouse's Place du Capitole, the city's main public square, by six Gestapo agents. He pulled out a revolver and opened fire on them. As crowds scattered, he dashed down several streets where he knew every turn and alley, ran into a building, and climbed the stairs to the roof. Leaping from roof to roof, he slipped away from the Germans and fled the city. He hid for most of June in a maquis near Quai Riguet, in the department of Ariège, in a rugged stretch of the Midi Pyrenees. From the hideout, he directed Morange ambushes and executions that quickly scrubbed 150 Nazis and collaborators. Tian Ye left on July 11th to meet in Toulouse with several of his Morange lieutenants, including Font, and entrusted the command of the Marquis to one of his deputies, André Audebeau. Accompanying Tian Ye was an operative named Georges, and 24-year-old Leo Amar, one of Tian Ye's most trusted and valiant agents. He had been with Morange since 1942, and his experience as a police inspector had proven invaluable in their infiltration of the Vichy Gendarmerie. As the three men drove out of the Toulouse neighborhood of Saint-Martin-du-Touche in a black Citroën, the streets teemed with Gestapo and German soldiers. The car slowed near the dam at the edge of the neighborhood, and then stopped in front of a guardhouse, where four Feldjägers, uniformed Nazi military policemen, with Schmeisser submachine guns, approached the car. One of the policemen demanded that Tian Ye and the others hand over their identification papers. Suspiciously eyeing the Frenchman, he grabbed Tian Ye's card and walked over to the guardhouse to crank the field telephone inside. According to operative Pierre Saint-Laurent, Tian Ye understood that he was trapped like a rat. There was not even time to draw their pistols. He ordered Georges and Leo Hamar to run. Instead, the two jumped from the left side of the car and rushed the officers so that Tian Ye could try to get away, and Morange would not lose its irreplaceable commander. As his two men punched and kicked the police, and others swarmed them, Tian Ye slipped out the right side of the Citroën and sprinted back down the street. By the time that the Germans finally overpowered his two companions, Tian Ye had vanished. He ducked into a blacksmith's forge, and the blacksmith told him to turn down a driveway that led to a church and an alley through which he could escape the police and Gestapo fanning out across the streets. Tian Ye reached the front of the church and spotted the alley to the left, the narrow passage between the wall and that of the building. He ran halfway down the alley and then paused. He thought that he had strayed into a dead end, and before reaching the bottom of the alley, he turned back. He skirted the church to his right and down another passageway, only to find, Saint-Laurent writes, the terrible surprise that he was in a cul-de-sac. With the harsh shouts of approaching Germans and the snarls and barks of attack dogs coming closer, Tian Ye scaled a large cross next to the church and climbed onto the steeply pitched roof, flattening himself onto it as Gestapo and police rushed past the church. Once again, it looked as though Ricardo had eluded the Nazis. A window suddenly opened on the house across the street from the church. A woman's shouts caused some of the Germans to stop and run back toward the sound. "There he is!" she yelled, pointing at the roof of the church. As Tian Ye squeezed off several shots from his revolver, the Germans opened up with rifles, submachine guns, and Lugers. Tiles shattered as rounds ripped into the roof and slammed into Tian Ye from head to toe. He tumbled from the roof, dead before he hit the street, riddled with bullets. The Gestapo dragged away his body. Days later, the long, dried-out trail of blood left by the body remained in the street, a warning to other men and women of the resistance. The warning went unheeded. On August 30th, 1944, in the garden of a building on Mignac Street, in Toulouse, Tian Ye's corpse was tossed by the Gestapo into a shallow ditch. A crudely lettered sign was tied to him. It read, "Death to France." Marcel Tian Ye was far more fortunate than Georges and Leo Amar. The Germans kicked Georges to death outside the car and hauled Amar off to Gestapo headquarters in Toulouse. For a week, he was tortured in every savage way his captors knew. Amar would not break, never revealing information about Morange. When the Gestapo realized that he would never talk, they did not end his agony with a bullet to the head. They chose instead to bury him alive. Chapter 29. Welcome back to the war. Packed into a van with the three Belgian escapees, Arthur and Cleaver endured their longest time on the road since the 8-hour drive with André Font from Perpignan to the Central Pyrenees. The van, driven by a guide who worked with the British and American consulates, made an uneventful 332-mile, 7-hour trip from Madrid southwest to the river port of Sevilla, despite the presence of Spanish civil guard and army trucks and armored cars along the route. Arthur and Cleaver had been told that the authorities rarely stopped vehicles on the highways between the two cities. Along with Gestapo and Abwehr agents, pro-Nazi Spanish officials and military preferred to lie in wait in Sevilla, which was the clearinghouse where pro-Allied Spaniards planned the last leg of the journey for airmen and pilots. The final destination was the legendary British fortress, the Rock of Gibraltar, which commanded the passage between the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea. If an escapee made it to Gibraltar, he was as good as home. The Nazis and their Spanish supporters knew it too, searching every route to Gibraltar in their effort to seize any unfortunate Allied pilots and airmen. There was a reason that both Madrid and now Sevilla served as way stations for fleeing Allied airmen. Both cities were so large that it was relatively easy for escapees to either hide or walk the streets before curfew with their identification papers. Still, exploring the two cities carried risks, as Gestapo agents often trailed English-speaking men and grabbed them in alleys, took their identification papers, summoned Spanish police on the Nazi payroll, and announced that the prisoners had no papers and were going to be taken to German territory. In his 2 days in Madrid, Arthur didn't see any Americans. Wary of going out in public as Americans and British airmen had done in Barcelona, he decided that it was better to lie low in Madrid until they left for Sevilla. As their van neared Sevilla, a vast plain stretched toward the Guadalquivir River, with the city sprawling in every direction along both banks, which flowed 80 miles to the Atlantic. The van turned along the western side of the Guadalquivir amid a breathtaking blend of civil buildings and houses whose architecture ran from Roman and Moorish to neoclassical and modern. The deeper they headed into the city, the narrower the side streets or closes became. The driver pulled into the Triana neighborhood, the birthplace of flamenco and famous for its unique style of ceramics, a place where medieval-era apartment houses still crowded against each other. Since the fall of France in 1940, Triana had served as a haven for Allied airmen because the neighborhood was as fervent a bastion of anti-Franco as well as anti-Nazi sympathy. During the Spanish Civil War, working-class Republican Triana had fiercely fought Franco's forces before the resistance was crushed by merciless reprisals. Now, the seething hatred along the river's west bank for Franco and Hitler meant that Arthur and Cleaver would find any number of men and women to help them escape Spain. From Sevilla to Gibraltar, the usual escape route for Allied airmen was a dangerous 119-mile drive from the city to the Rock along roads heavily patrolled by the Spanish Army and the Civil Guard. Luck played a huge role if soldiers or militia stopped a car or van with escaping Allied airmen and pilots. The consulates in Barcelona had provided Arthur and Cleaver with Spanish pesos to bribe border patrols to let them cross into Gibraltar. Sometimes, though, German agents who paid police, soldiers, and civil guards far more than the amount the escapees could offer accompanied the authorities, especially when the Nazis were searching for a specific high-value person. Cleaver fell squarely into that category. The Gestapo knew he was in Spain, and their agents were undoubtedly waiting along the road to Gibraltar with Spaniards on the take. Getting Cleaver to safety meant that his and Arthur's guides would have to use a second, far more hazardous escape route, one that meant a 115-mile drive from Sevilla to the southwestern port of Algeciras, and then a 7-mile trip by boat to Gibraltar through waters where U-boats still prowled, and Spanish planes could order a vessel to turn back to Algeciras. Nazi agents were stationed all along the docks of the port to hunt for any hint of Allied airmen and pilots boarding a fishing boat or smack. Vessels carrying any such escapees were frequently sunk if a U-boat was alerted in time by coded messages from onshore. Arthur could have opted to go with the Belgians by the easier route entirely by car. His chances of reaching Gibraltar were far better that way. For him, however, there was no question which route he would choose. He would stay with Cleaver, running the gauntlet from Algeciras to Gibraltar by boat. Before dawn on Friday, June 16th, a car pulled up at the safe house in Sevilla. Arthur and Cleaver, in worn but clean clothes and decent shoes provided by their hosts, climbed into the car, having carefully checked that they had their identification papers and their cash. As the car waded into the crowded streets of the city and turned south along the coastal road for the drive to Algeciras, the American and the Englishman had already traveled over 1,000 miles on their winding journey from Toulouse to Sevilla. They knew that the final 7, from Algeciras to Gibraltar, could well prove the most nerve-wracking and lethal. High above the shoreline of southwestern Spain, every mile on the roadway brought vistas of the sun glinting off the Atlantic. As always along the highways leading south, cars, vans, and trucks were pulled over by police and militia for inspection of travelers' papers, an unnerving sight for the American and the Englishman, who both tensed every time an official-looking car or a military vehicle suddenly appeared alongside or behind them. Approaching Algeciras near 7 a.m., some 3 hours after departing Sevilla, the car hit traffic that had come to a near standstill. Several police cars and army half-tracks were parked on both sides of the highway, and police officers and civil guards, in dark blue uniforms and German-issue jackboots, and toting German submachine guns, were questioning the occupants of every car, van, and truck. Every now and then, they waved vehicles to pull over to the side and ordered the drivers and passengers to step outside. Most ominously, several men in fedoras and dark suits challenged travelers. Arthur had seen enough of their type in Toulouse to recognize them instantly as Gestapo agents. The presence of Nazis would spoil any attempts to bribe Spaniards working with the Nazis up ahead. While Arthur and Cleaver did have the correct identification to pass through neutral Spain, this wouldn't matter if the Spanish police and soldiers looked the other way as the Gestapo seized the identification documents. Cleaver's face and actual name were on his papers, and the Toulouse Gestapo wanted him back. Arthur had no doubt that the Germans would extradite him along with the RAF pilot. A Jewish airman carrying a concealed weapon would not fare well back in Nazi territory. The turn of Arthur, Cleaver, and their driver came after an interminable wait of over an hour. Even if they got through the checkpoint, they had to be at the dock before nightfall, because the U-boats would surface only at night to recharge their batteries and replenish the air inside, or to stop and board a suspicious vessel. By day, it was too dangerous for the submarines to surface, with Allied fighter planes from the airfield at Gibraltar combing the waters below. Under the relative cover of darkness, sometimes a U-boat simply sank ships that matched the descriptions from Nazi agents dockside at Algeciras. At the order of a civil guard, Arthur, Cleaver, and the driver handed over their papers. The Spaniard looked them over and returned them. He waved the car forward. No matter how much relief filled Arthur and Cleaver, the feeling ebbed quickly. Nazi agents were waiting along the port's docks, studying every man and woman there. The car traveled down several streets that were filled with cafes and shops and turned onto the Avenida del Carmen, the large commercial roadway running along the waterfront. Spanish Navy destroyers were anchored at large piers, and countless freighters and fishing vessels of all shapes and sizes clogged the harbor. Directly east across the Bay of Gibraltar, the massive algae-flecked granite face of the rock jutted from dark blue, almost violet waters, a small bank of fog covering the summit, where the British fortress stood. Freedom lay within sight of Arthur and Cleaver, but running the gauntlet to Gibraltar promised to be 7 of the longest miles of both men's lives. The driver stopped in front of a dilapidated fishing boat with peeling red and green paint and barnacles encrusting the hull just above the waterline. A rusty crane and winch hovered above the stern, and patched-up nets were fastened to the gunwales. Surprisingly, the vessel's engines were already running and humming strongly, creating a large backwash from the propellers at the stern. Arthur and Cleaver sprang from the car and hustled up a swaying gangplank and onto the vessel. As instructed, they did not look around for watchful Nazi agents, avoiding any movement that could arouse suspicion. The car had left by the time they turned around. Within a few minutes, the captain, standing in the wheelhouse, throttled the craft into reverse near 9 a.m., and eased it from the pier and into the channel. As with all Allied escapees on a fishing boat, Arthur and Cleaver were handed woolen sailors' watch caps and oily smocks that reeked of grease and fish. Slowly gathering more speed, the vessel churned down the channel for the waters of the Bay of Gibraltar. No one said a word to the two passengers. Unsure what to do, Arthur and Cleaver stood together by the port gunwale and fought to keep their balance as the vessel plowed into choppy, white-capped waters. Several planes flew in low circles above the bay, some with the all-too-familiar hum that Arthur recognized as that of the Henschel 126. Much of the Spanish military's equipment, vehicles, and planes had come from Germany. For the first few years of the war, the Nazis had pressured Spain to enter the fray on Hitler's side and capture Gibraltar. However, Franco's determination to keep the German army off Spanish soil thwarted Hitler's Operation Felix, the Nazis' plan to capture Gibraltar. Franco became increasingly concerned that he faced the threat of invasion from both the Germans and the Allies, playing a skillful but dangerous game of duplicity with both sides, until he gauged which way the war was going. In June 1944, the landings at Normandy cemented the dictator's decision. Hitler would lose, and Spain would do as little as possible to help the Nazi war effort henceforth. Still, Spanish officials collaborating with the Nazis were aiding Gestapo efforts to take back escaping Allied airmen. The Gestapo prowled ports and other escape routes for Allied airmen for several months to come. As planes darted down over the plotting fishing vessel and circled it several times, Arthur hoped that from above, he and Cleaver looked like ordinary Algeciras fishermen. On every run to Gibraltar with Allied airmen aboard a fishing boat, one of the crew stood at the bow and another at the stern, peering at the water in every direction. They were searching for the tiny telltale wake of a U-boat's periscope among the whitecaps. The boat felt like it was trying to blow through cement, and for a long while the mass of the rock did not appear to be getting any closer. Halfway there, the currents grew heavier, the vessel's progress seemingly slowing to inches. A scout plane was dogging the craft, passing slowly over her and back again and again. The pilot had to be looking for something or someone. To throw off pesky scouts, crewmen would lower a few nets into the water in an attempt to trick the pilots into believing that a fishing run, not an escape, was underway. The scout above was apparently not buying it, keeping the boat squarely in view. The captain, the crew, and the two passengers had no way to know if the pilot was playing games or tracking the vessel for a German U-boat. There was another distressing possibility. For the first 2 miles into the bay, sleek, speedy German E-boats, coastal patrol craft, with Spanish Navy crews, could stop and board any vessel they wanted to in Spanish waters. Several E-boats were on the water around Arthur and Cleaver, but were battling the rough